Good afternoon. This is Stephen Campbell, your host for Murders, Mysteries, and Mayhem. Today is Monday, February 10th, and this is episode number 36. My guest today is New York Times bestselling author Barry Eisler, whose latest book, Graveyard of Memories, the eighth book in the John Rain series, is being released tomorrow. I've been a fan of this series since the first book was published in 2002, and this latest book takes us back, even earlier than that first book, by telling the John Rain origin story. Of course, no conversation with Barry Eisler would be complete without a discussion of the state of the publishing industry. For those who may not know, Barry was the first big-time author to turn his back on traditional publishing by turning down a $500,000 advance in 2011 to self-publish. Since that time, he's been helping to lead the charge to educate authors on the new options available to them in the digital publishing age.
To cost-effectively reach a mass market audience, you needed a distribution partner. In digital, this is not true. In digital, a lone author can distribute per book 100% as effectively as a multi-million dollar international conglomerate.
In this interview, we talk in depth about the John Rain series, Barry's decision to republish the audio versions of the series with himself as the reader, and we get a master's level education on the current state of the publishing business. But the interview starts with Barry sharing his overview of tomorrow's release of Graveyard of Memories.
What can I tell you? Graveyard of Memories is a prequel, a John Rain prequel set in Tokyo in 1972. It's really an origin of Rain's story. And I got the idea for it really based on just fragments of Rain's origins that have been revealed in various of the other Rain books. The central question is, where does a master assassin and also a master survivalist, someone who's survived as long as Rain has in a very dangerous business, where does he come from? What are his formative experiences? Were there just lots of little incremental steps he took along the way that shaped him? Was there anything more dramatic than any of that? Was there a crucible in which he was primarily formed? And in mulling over those questions, I started to come up with a story, and that story became Graveyard of Memories. So in this book, you'll see Rain. He's fresh from combat in Vietnam. He's 20 years old. He's not a guy you would want to mess with. He's certainly a dangerous character. But he's also unformed and hot-headed and immature, not tactical, not particularly skilled at reading and manipulating people, that sort of thing. So it was fascinating and fun for me to be with someone who I recognized from the later Rain books, certainly, but more the way I recognize, like, okay, this is where it all came from. He makes a lot of mistakes in this book. Sometimes he's lucky that the mistakes didn't turn out worse than they actually did, and that he has the capacity to learn from them. So we'll see his development through his reactions to surviving those mistakes. Anyway, that's the gist of it, I think.
And that's sort of one of the themes of the book that you bring out later in the book, just the idea of all the good fortune that he had, which, you know, turns out to have, to a certain extent, had was a part of the story itself. But he was unnaturally lucky for the character that we know as John Rain, who is such a planner, is so tactical, who thinks about everything, who will spend an hour and a half walking two blocks to make sure he's not being followed. This guy's not like that at all.
No, he learns those lessons the hard way. And anyone who says, you can think of Rain on an almost banal level as being someone who's successful. I don't think that's necessarily the first adjective that would come to anyone's mind when describing a contract killer. But he is. He's been successful in this business and successful at surviving. And I think that anyone who's being honest with himself or herself about his or her own success has to acknowledge the critical importance of luck. So that's not to say that hard work isn't important, education, all that sort of thing. But if you really look back, I think, honestly, at the sources of your own success, so much of it is going to be built on just blind good luck, or at the minimum, the absence of bad luck. I mean, just to use one trivial example, if I step outside the house right now, for all the hard work I've ever done during my life, if a brick were to fall on my head, then all that hard work would come to nothing, and that would just be a little bit of bad luck. So it's even just the absence of that bad luck is also very important for success. That was important for me in designing Rain 2. This is a guy who's got great skills, great reflexes, combat experience, natural adaptability, a lot of qualities that you would think, well, these things are probably going to be useful in making someone skilled and successful as an assassin. But he's also in over his head in this story. He's only 20 years old. And so, yeah, sometimes he does the tactically right thing, but more often than not, he gets into trouble. And then sometimes his youthful reflexes are there for him, but even those are in some measure the product of luck. And other times it's just blind luck, and then he's able to say, whoa, what can I learn from this? How can I adapt from this and apply it in subsequent situations? So that was fun for me because it's something I think that's universally applicable, but being presented in a series of tactics and violent encounters that I think my readers seem to enjoy, and I know I do.
And it's interesting because your readers, me being one of them, we enjoy getting inside John Rain's head, and you do a great job of bringing us inside his thought process. And you did that in this book, where every time he'd make a mistake, he sensed that he was doing something wrong, and there was no turning back for him. He went ahead and hoped he could learn
right.
from it. And then so we learned
right.
along with him as he was gaining this tactical skill rather quickly through the course of the book.
Yeah, so that's one of the things he does have going for him. That's that capacity to learn. So some people are, depending on the topic and circumstances, that sort of thing, some people learn more quickly, some people learn more slowly. He's not in a situation, he's not in circumstances that are going to be particularly forgiving if he doesn't learn fast. The book starts out with Rain's a bagman. He's working for the CIA, doing what should be pretty easy and straightforward. He's just carrying a bag full of cash about once a week as a courier between that's being delivered by the CIA to corrupt elements of the Japanese government. And he gets jumped in Ueno. This is the first chapter, actually, yeah. And with a little bit of luck, he handles it wrong, but also his skills are pretty good also, and he's able to get out of this thing successfully. But in short order, he finds himself in a kind of war with the Yakuza because the people who jumped him are like the wrong people to handle that way. And this is just not something that Rain is in any kind of shape to really deal with. He doesn't live that kind of life. He doesn't know that kind of life yet. So he's got to ramp up really fast, and that's part of what made the book such a joy for me to write.
And at the end of the book, you do what you always do. That there are acknowledgments, and you talked about the way you picked the settings for this particular book, so that
right.
the places where things took place in most instances were still standing in Tokyo today. So someone could
mm-hmm.
go and find that place. And I've seen pictures of you online where you're over in Tokyo researching these things. So that's obviously something that's very important to you.
Yeah, I for so many reasons, and some of my friends and family like to give me a hard time. I said, like, what do? Do you just find good places you want to go, like Barcelona and Paris and Phuket, and say, man, I really need to set a story there? And it's half true. I certainly am not – I don't want to go to a place that doesn't interest me. Why would anyone want to do that? But it's not quite as simple as just saying, I think I need to go to Bora Bora. How can I set a story there? Although I did set a story in Bora Bora. Best research ever. But anyway, but the place has to be relevant in the story. It's not totally random. It's more like the intersection of what's relevant in the story and places that otherwise interest me, and then I start to see what's going to work. So I love Tokyo. I mean, I've lived there, on and off for a total of Tokyo 2 years, Japan 4 years. And Tokyo is one of my favorite cities on earth. So for a variety of reasons, I just love the atmosphere in Tokyo, and so getting to describe that city through Rain's eyes is one of, I just love it, it's one of my favorite things. Being in Tokyo is itself one of my favorite things, but then to try to convey and depict the city through Rain's eyes and his experiences is wonderful for me. So, so of course I like the travel research for those reasons, but also I find that going to real places for me is both it both creates inspiration for really good sequences, but it also creates a kind of discipline that makes the sequences better. And here's what I mean. You might think that, oh, well, look, if you can just design all the topography yourself using your imagination, and it's boundless, you can do anything you want, then you could come up with some really cool sequences. And that may be true, at least for some writers, I don't know. What I find for myself, though, is that when I'm limited by reality, then the story has to improve because it's in opposition with actual real-world obstacles that I can't just write away. So that's the discipline for me. I change almost nothing, and if I do change something, there'll be a good reason for it. And I'll note that in an author's note at the end, because I want readers to know all these places are not just real, but they're as I found them. I haven't changed any details. I've made the sequences work the way they would, the way they would have to work in the real world. And I'll give you a quick example of a time when I noticed how this works. I was working on my third book, and I was out east for Thanksgiving where I have some relatives, and Rain is going to break into an apartment building, just get into an apartment, guys, into an apartment, in an apartment building, and kind of lie in wait for this guy and interrogate him. And because I like to use things that I'm familiar with, I thought, you know what, I'll just use the old apartment I used to live in when, in fact, I was working at the CIA. So I thought, I'll just refresh my recollection. I'm out here. It's easy. I just drove out to the old apartment building. I hadn't been there in about 10 years. Well, this was now post 9/11, and every place has had its security beefed up since then, just every place, including this apartment building, which when I was there, you could just walk in and out any time, day or night. The front door wasn't locked. There's no doorman, nothing. Now it's got magnetic key access, a doorman, cameras. This is just a whole different security posture. And my first reaction was, oh, my God, this is too hard. I can't use this place. But then I thought, hey, you're John Rain. You can't just say, oh, I can't use this place. Let's make the guy live someplace else. That's bullshit. And I thought, you got to get into this building. How are you going to do it? And that sequence became so much better because I didn't take a lazy way out and just say, oh, I'll just use an easy place so that my character can accomplish his mission. It's like, no, this is a really hard place, and he has to accomplish it anyway. And I've done the same thing in hotels. If someone has to get into a room, it's like, you know, you see in movies, it always irritates me, people just magically get into hotel rooms and houses, or they have to, they're doing some kind of surveillance, say a vehicular surveillance, and they can just park in the car on a quiet residential street and nobody questions them, and they never have to deal with what do you do when you have to take a leak. It's just never dealt with. So that kind of realism, all kinds of realism actually, are really important to me because I like realistic thrillers, and because my brand, I think, is predicated on realism. So in every way I can, I try to make everything as realistic as possible, certainly the locations, but also all the tactics, the kind of operator mindset that a guy like Rain would have, the political backstory is all from the headlines. And everything I can, I do to create a story that's functionally this. What would happen if I took a real place, in a real setting, real circumstances, everything we know, this does exist in the real world, and drop some fictional characters in it, then what would happen? I like that kind of thriller.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a scene in the book, there are a couple scenes I want to talk specifically about that kind of tie in with what you're talking about. One was when John was teaching himself or being taught how to pick locks.
Mm-hmm.
He had a need to pick a lock in the book, but he didn't know how. And he
That's another thing, by the way. People, you know, in movies, they're always hot wiring engines,
right,
and picking
right.
locks.
Yeah. And so I thought, oh, yeah, that's the kind of thing
that you
could draw that up with two lines. You know, he looked it up on you can't look it up on the internet in 1972. But you spent pages of description of going through the process of finding the person that could teach him, and then being taught, and then going out and actually picking the lock. It was fascinating.
Thank you for saying that. And that would be a good example of what I'm talking about. Instead of just magically imbuing him with the ability to pick locks, this is a guy who now he can, but where did that come from? How did he learn that? And that sequence, several people tell me they love that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Even though if you think about it, I mean, it's not really a critical sequence in the book. It's more just, how did Rain get from A to B? Doesn't know how to pick locks. Now he's not an expert, but he's getting there. He's got some basic know-how. How does he get from point A to point B? So that's where that whole scene came from. And there's a lot more going on in that scene than just Rain learning how to pick locks. He's also learning how to read people because the old Benvia, the Candyman, Mr. Mm-hmm. Everything, Mr. Convenience, who the Zainichi, an old Korean guy living in Koreatown in Tokyo. But he's teaching him how to pick locks. But this is a canny old guy. And he's actually manipulating Rain a little bit. And at some point during their time together, Rain starts to get an inkling of what this guy's doing and how these sorts of negotiations go. So he's learning other things in his time with the Benvia too, the Nandemuya, another way of saying it. Handyman.
And we readers learned right along with him because that was a great scene. There was another scene that was particularly, it was a small scene, but it was interesting, and it was Rain and someone else, and I don't want to go into any detail about who the other person was, but going down these steep steps into a jazz club. So it's interesting for a couple reasons. One, it's Rain's introduction essentially to jazz. And we all know in future books he becomes more and more of a jazz aficionado. This was sort of his introduction to jazz, and it was just a great scene, and there's no way to talk about it without giving away an important story point, but it was really good. And I think I saw in the author's notes that was one of the few places that's not still there, but there is a place just like that that's there now.
Yeah, that's right. The closest I could come to using that jazz club in Shinjuku, which is gone now, is to use a successor club called Body and Soul that's in Minami Aoyama. So, but I wanted to use the original place. It's gone, so I had to, what could I do? I just had to imagine it as best I can. But I love Body and Soul in Minami Aoyama. So this is a way of saying, okay, the original place, it's just gone. You can't get to it anymore. But if you want to see the successor, it's a move twice. It's now called Body and Soul, and it does still exist.
Now, a couple other fun things that had to have been fun for you writing this was we began to see John becoming expert in things like scotch, and I don't remember in later books whether he really loved coffee or not, but he just the experience he had with coffee in this particular book was fascinating, and I felt like kind of a schlep for making coffee the way I make it in the morning.
Yeah, he's definitely a fan of really good coffee. I wouldn't call it a major point to subsequent books, but it comes up, and for anyone who likes coffee, if you live in Tokyo is one of the greatest coffee cities on earth. I don't know how well known this is, but one of the things I love about Japan is there's something in the national culture that seems to work like this. Japanese will identify something that they think is valuable, and it doesn't really matter that much whether it comes, as far as I can tell, whether it comes from Japan or whether it's something that that comes into Japan from abroad. If they think it has value, they examine it really closely and try to figure out what's its essence, what makes it work, what makes it best. And then they obsessively try to reproduce that. And so coffee would be one instance. I mean, there are people in Japan that have made their life's work figuring out all the things that make a perfect cup of coffee. They're obsessed with it. It's not too strong a word. And so the coffee we're talking about is not cheap. I mean, some of these places will charge $10 for a cup, but it's not the kind of place you go for your morning Starbucks caffeine hit. It's the experience of going into a place that's been there for 50 years or longer, run by a proprietor who might be in his 90s. At this point, I'm thinking of a place called Cafe Lambra in Ginza. And I spent a lifetime learning how to make perfect, what he considers to be perfect coffee, perfecting his craft. And then he makes it right in front of you. He'll tell you about the various beans he's got, the ages, where they're sourced, grind them right in front of you. If you want to talk about it, he'll tell you is he grinding them fine? Is he grinding them thick? What's the temperature of the water? How do you pour it? What kind of water? All this kind of stuff. You get to watch him make the cup. And it's just beautiful. I love this. There are whiskey bars that I could describe in similar terms. I knew one place which I've used in one of my books called Bar Sato. It's actually in Osaka. I moved it to Tokyo and called that out in an author's note at the end because I just said, this bar is so good, it's just got to be in the book, even though it is, in fact, in Osaka, but here's the address. Anyway, Sato-san is a salaryman who got sick of life on the rat wheel of corporate Japan, and he got out. He loves whiskey. And he just found a way to turn the first floor of his house into an absolutely wonderful bar. He now makes up to 4 trips to Scotland a year, just sourcing what he considers to be the best, most unusual Scotch whiskey. He brings it back, and he runs his bar. So anyway, this is one of the things I love about Japan. And if you love coffee, it's something you can really indulge in when you're in Japan. For anyone who's curious, my website has links to a lot of different places that appear in the books, wonderful coffee places and other places too. Anyway, for a guy like Rain, who subsequently, who in later books we know really appreciates good coffee, where did that come from? Well, he came of age in Tokyo. That'd be a pretty good place for it. And that's actually what happened to me. So I used that for the character too.
Now, I'm assuming there's going to be an audio book for Graveyard of Memories.
Yes. In fact, there already is, but it won't be out until...
Tell us who the reader is for this book.
Well, I'm the reader, and I've now narrated in several marathon sessions my entire backlist, too. So publication of all the audiobooks will be just today. It would be tomorrow, February 11th. And, I really enjoy narrating the books. And, I don't know, quite a few years ago when I did Inside Out with Random House, and so... Let me back up for 1 second. Once I heard Stephen King talking about this process that writers go through, and I love this. He said, so there's a process every writer goes through, and it's like this. One day you'll be in an airport kiosk or something. You'll be just thumbing through a new paperback bestseller, and you'll suddenly realize something that's critical to every writer. What you'll realize is, this sucks. He says, you'll suddenly realize, I could do better than this. And he says, this is a critical moment on the path of any writer. So I listen to a ton of audiobooks. I've always loved audiobooks. And some of them are indescribably good. I mean, recently I listened to Will Patton reading Stephen King's book, Dr. Sleep, magic. Craig Wasson, I'll listen to anything Craig Wasson reads. Blair Brown doing Isabel Allende, oh my God. I even just listened to, I was kind of embarrassed, I never read... To Kill a Mockingbird for some reason, and I just realized it's kind of a gap. So I picked up the audiobook, Sissy Spacek. It was just unbelievable to hear someone with that level of acting talent reading such a great book. So anyway, audiobooks can, some of the narrators are just phenomenal. But some of them suck. And in my opinion, obviously these are subjective things, and I listened to a lot of them. So listening to so many of them, I started to develop a notion of not just what sucks, but why it sucks and how it could be done better. And when I did Inside Out with Random House, I asked them if they'd be okay with me taking a crack at the audiobook. And they said, well, okay, but you have to audition for it like anybody else would. If you get accepted, we'll just pay you the minimum amount we pay a narrator. And if we don't accept you, then you can't whine about it. That's the rules. I think it seemed quite fair to me. Anyway, so I did. I sent them an audition CD, and I was pretty sure I just had a feeling they were just doing this to humor me. But then I got this email saying, well, listen, we listened to this thing, and we were surprised. It's really good. Yeah, let's do this. I was like, all right. So I did Inside Out. The reaction was really good. The New York Times said some very kind things about my narration skills. And since then, I've been narrating all the new books. Recently, about a year ago, I got rights back to my entire backlist. Mm-hmm. That's 8 novels. And so Brilliance Audio and I signed a new audio publishing agreement whereby I went out to Grand Haven, Michigan, and recorded, I don't know, over the course of about 6 months, what did we do? It was crazy. It was like 8 books and 4 short stories or something like that. It was a lot of recording. But as of February 11th, my entire oeuvre of 10 novels and 4 short works will all be available in audio with me as the narrator. And I'm excited about that because it's somewhat unusual. We've got unified packaging for all of it. We've got one narrator for all of it, which is nice. I've never had that. All my publishers always had a new narrator for each new book, which is crazy for a series.
I noticed that when I was looking at the audiobooks. I like you, really enjoy listening to audiobooks, but you cannot change the narrator in the middle of the series.
Yeah, that's right. Not for a series. That's right. Totally agree. So that was something I think my audio backlist was always suffering from, and no longer now. We've got hopefully a good narrator. I mean, I think at least from reactions of listeners, seem to be doing something right. And unified packaging is the same narrative for all the books. And I think people who like audiobooks, which is a pretty huge number of people at this point and mm-hmm. still growing, I think they're going to want to give these a try. So anyway, I'm ridiculously excited about the audiobooks. It's funny, you think like audio has always been a kind of like a sub-right, you know. I wouldn't call it a backwater because it's just been steadily growing for the last mm-hmm. at least 10 years. But it's not the first thing you think about, like, oh, my, you know, people don't say, like, oh, the new audiobook is coming out. You know, it's like the book is coming out and it'll also be available on audio. But I'm just hugely excited to have Graveyard of Memories and the whole backlist all available in audio, MP3, CD, regular CD, and, of course, digital download. It makes me feel good that I feel like we've finally gotten the whole thing right and packaged it right.
Now, because you listen to a lot of audiobooks, I'll ask you this question. I wouldn't ask most people this, but do you find yourself, if there's a series and you really like the reader, do you then prefer to listen to the audiobook over reading the book itself?
Oh, yeah, sometimes. I mean, like as an example, as much as I love James Ellroy, and I've read plenty of his books in paper or digital, and the guy's voice is just incredible. There's no one who can write like Ellroy. He's really got a unique voice. But if you've ever listened to Craig Wasson narrating James Ellroy, it's sick. I mean, those guys, they were just born to do something like this together. And I mentioned Blair Brown a little while ago. As much as I love Isabel Allende, God, I love the way Blair Brown reads her.
Mm-hmm.
So, and by the way, you know, it's interesting to me how widespread is a kind of prejudice against audiobooks. It makes so little sense to me that when I encounter it, it always surprises me. And the prejudice goes something like this. First of all, it goes like this. Oh, you listened to that book. Well, then you didn't really read it. And I said, what do you mean? I mean, and, you know, on a very narrow technical level, I wouldn't say that listening to someone else read something is the same as reading it yourself. I wouldn't say that. It's a different function. I think most people would agree with that. That's not the point they're making. They're not saying, well, technically these are two different functions. What they're saying is listening to someone else read the book somehow inherently has less value than reading it directly. And I just don't understand that. If we consider any of the values, any of the reasons that we might as people and as a society value reading, I can't think of a single one that's served by direct reading but not served by listening to someone else read. To me, it's roughly equal, even though the experiences are somewhat different in various respects. These are distinctions without a real meaningful difference. So that's one thing I don't understand. And then if you question people more closely, they say odd things like, well, but if you listen to someone else reading it, then you're not hearing it the way the author intended it to be read.
Hmm.
And that, to me, is fascinating because it's so mistaken, but also mistaken as a form of narcissism. Because implicit in this argument is the notion that when I read a book, the way I read it in my own head, the way it's sounding in my own head, which is the product of myself, my own reading, mixed, of course, with what the author's written, but still it's the product of whatever's going on in my own mind. This is the result that the author intended. That's just crazy to me. So, you know, when I read my own books out loud, like, this is how I want them to sound. It's true. I don't know if I'm able to fully to deliver on that, but when you read one of my books directly, you bring all kinds of things into it, enunciation, voices, rhythm, I don't know, that I didn't intend, and that's mixing with what I wrote, and that's beautiful. That's what reading is about. So all we're doing with an audiobook is replacing someone else's interpretation of how the book should be read with your interpretation. And why would yours be in some way valid and another person's invalid? That just seems really weird to me. So anyway, I do encounter these things and they seem strange. But anything that gets people to experience books more is for me an inherently good thing. And so many people spend so much time in the car. That's why I listen to books constantly, mm-hmm. just constantly. And I don't even have a commute to speak of. I mean, if you have a serious commute, you could be doing an audiobook a week easily if you've got a significant commute. So anything that gets people to experience books more to me is a wonderful thing. So I think that might have been a little bit of a discursive response to what we were saying about audiobooks. But I love them. I think they're hugely valuable, hugely fun. And yeah, so, and for some narrators are so magical combined with certain authors that yes, I actually do slightly prefer this is a way of saying it. Like when I read, I forget the name of the narrator, it's embarrassing, but I've listened to two of the George R. R. Martin Game of Thrones series in the car, and the narrator is a god walking the earth, but I'm embarrassed because I can't remember his name. He really deserves recognition. But anyway, I'm sure George R. R. Martin is fantastic on the page, but it's almost like the way I would read George R. R. Martin, I could never do Martin's prose and characters and stories the justice that this professional actor is doing them. I would rather listen to the professional actor reading it than the way it sounds in my own mind without him helping out. That's kind of how it feels to me.
Yeah, and
I know that. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm the same way. It's like you get a professional who's reading the books, pronouncing these obscure cities correctly. in your books, for example, words that I couldn't begin to figure out how to pronounce, they all just flow off the tongue, and it's magical with the right reader and the right author. And for people to think that's an inferior form of taking in a book, it is really foolish.
Yeah, I think it's, in general, it's the product of thoughtlessness, and people just haven't really considered it. So we all have... I think there are different kinds of prejudices in the world, and hopefully the most common is the kind that's just the product of, we've never paused to think about this. It's just an attitude that for some reason you've absorbed, that's been inculcated, and you've never paused to examine it. And then once you do examine it, you realize, oh, that actually is pretty foolish. Doesn't make any sense. And yeah, I think the prejudice against audiobooks, which if you think about it, is probably one of the less invidious forms of prejudice that you'll find in the world. It's just a product of, it's just an attitude and people haven't really thought about it. And once they get exposed to audiobooks, I think that attitude is probably not going to be able to stand up to the reality of just how rich and wonderful an experience it can be to listen to a really good narrator read a really good book.
All right, let's move on to a specific book that you've written that was not one of the John Rain books. It was one of my personal favorites. I spent years in the technology business. I know you spent some time in the technology business as well. You have been an attorney. You worked in Silicon Valley. And the book Fault Line, which was the first Ben Treven book, it brought some of that into play. How much of Alex in that book was you?
Well, a certain amount, but that's also true for every character I've ever written, because for me, the process of creating a character is something like this. You have to recognize something in yourself, I think. Otherwise, where would that character even come from? So you recognize something in your personality, some attitude or world aspect of your worldview, something, and then you try to distill that thing out and then culture it in a different medium and see, and in that new medium it takes a different form. So you're working on a new character. So who's this guy? He's this ambitious young attorney. And Alex, for example, is far more ambitious about his law firm plans than I ever was. I enjoyed being a lawyer. I think I was reasonably good at it, but it was never, I always knew this was not what was best in me, and I was kind of frustrated that this was the path, or call it rut, that I had wound up in, and concerned me because I didn't want to stay on that path. So yes, Alex and I were both lawyers in both associates in Silicon Valley technology law firms, but Alex is much more ambitious than I was, than I ever was, and that sort of thing. So I'm getting a feel for his overall character, and then I take certain things that I know about what it feels like to work in a big firm like that and start asking myself, okay, well, how would that thing feel? How would you experience it if you were Alex? And that's how characters, for me anyway, start to take shape. So, yeah, broad similarities. And I get this question asked with regard to Rain all the time. Like, what are the similarities? And of course there are going to be some. But we've also had very different experiences. I mean, like,
well,
I have my cynical...
So.
Yeah, that's right. I have my cynical moments. How can you not if you're, unless you're not paying attention? But overall, I think my nature is much more optimistic. Just not proud of it, not ashamed of it. It just seems to be the way I'm wired. Whereas a guy like Rain has had some very hard and embittering experiences in his life. If you take what in me would just be a strand of cynicism and then plant it in a personality like Rain, where does it go? How does it grow? What becomes of it? I don't know. That's kind of a broad answer to your question, but that's what's going on anytime I create a character. There's always going to be something I have in common with that character, but it will express itself in quite different ways once it's distilled out and then cultured within that character.
Okay. Well, for years, you have been a best-selling author. Your books were selling well from the very beginning, and you're very well known, and then this incident happened that got a lot of publicity a few years ago, and for people in the independent publishing side of the business, it was apocalyptic.
Right.
You walked away from a reported $500,000 advance to self-publish.
Right.
True story?
Yeah, it's a true story, and I could go on at length about it, but I'll try to keep my answer reasonably brief. It's not something I think I'm always as good at as I should be. But let me just mention now, for anyone who's curious about a lot more about this and, you know, what it can mean for you in terms of making your own decisions about how to publish a book or a story in, or any story in the new world of self-publishing, or the new world of publishing in which we find ourselves, I would recommend a long online conversation I had with writer J.A. Conrath, which we published as a book called Be the Monkey. You can find it on either one of our websites for free. I think on Amazon it's 99 cents because we're not allowed to publish it for free there. I forget. But you can download it for free on either of our websites, Be the Monkey, which is, again, a very long discussion, detailed discussion about everything that went into this decision. But basically, it's like, I don't know, how do I do this really briefly? It's like this. Well, you know, part of my concern is this. Like Noam Chomsky, you're wondering why I'm talking about Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky once said this thing that was just brilliant, and I recommend people look it up. It's just Google Noam Chomsky decision, and he talks about why he's not that good on television. What he says is like, look, if you want to talk about things that are just the kind of received wisdom, that the conventional wisdom that everyone agrees on, you can talk about them concisely because everybody's got an existing, implicit, almost unconscious framework for understanding the points you're making. You can make the points very briefly. They fit into the whole framework that everyone already understands, and you can get through it pretty quickly. That's concision, and it's valued on television. But if you want to do anything that is at all iconoclastic, then you have to build a new framework of understanding for the points you're trying to make, and that is much more difficult to do with concision. And that has been my experience in the world. So anyway, I'm trying to think about how to make this really short. And I guess I would look at it, I would do it like this. Here are my bullet points. Digital dissemination has changed publishing enormously. I don't think it's too strong a statement to say that digital distribution provides the basis for a revolution in publishing, because distributing books in paper, the nature of paper meant that you needed trucks and warehouses, et cetera, scarcity of supply, scarcity of bookshelves and stores, all sorts of artifacts of paper distribution that shaped the way the publishing business grew and developed. Digital has changed many of these things. Most fundamentally, what digital means to authors is that we no longer need a distribution partner. Whenever I say this, people always say, like, how are you going to get known? Don't you need marketing? Blah, blah, blah. My response to that is, I'm talking about distribution. Marketing is different. Discoverability, that's the current buzzword, has always been a problem in every business, not just the book world. And there are lots of different ways of marketing, and publishers, traditional publishers or legacy publishers, whatever you want to call them, do provide a marketing function. But I'm not talking about that now. I'm just talking about how do you physically get books into the hands of readers. And before digital, to do that, you needed a distribution partner, which is primarily what a publisher has always been. Because distribution, paper distribution, is the one thing authors have never been able to do on their own, at least not cost effectively. You could have books printed at Kinko's and load them up in the station wagon and drive around the country, but you will not be able to cost effectively reach a mass market audience doing that. To cost effectively reach a mass market audience, you needed a distribution partner. In digital, this is not true. In digital, a lone author can distribute her book 100% as effectively as a multi-million dollar international conglomerate. This is a fact, and it's hard to get your head around if you've never really thought about it before. And so people resist by saying, like, but the editorial and the marketing. And that those are very important considerations, but they are separate considerations. I'm only talking about distribution, which is most fundamental in the traditional publishing relationship. The most fundamental value that traditional publishers have offered has always been paper distribution. The other value adds, having to do with editorial and copy editing and proofreading and cover design and marketing and promotion and that sort of thing, those values are built on top of the fundamental value, which is distribution. And I say fundamental because, again, the only thing that authors have never been able to outsource, I could hire a freelance editor, or I could hire a marketing firm, or, and typically many authors do, in fact, hire PR specialists, copy editors, cover design people. Publishers themselves outsource almost all of these functions. They are available for a flat fee. The one thing an author has never been able to get outside the traditional publishing industry is paper distribution, distribution itself, because distribution was all paper. And now an author can distribute her books all by herself, 100% effectively as a publisher. So then the question is, well, what makes the most sense for me? How do I want to do this? And here, this is turning into a long answer. I'm sorry. How do I wrap this up?
That's what I was hoping for. Go ahead.
Okay. There are a lot of misunderstandings out there. And one of them, I think, is this. There's something in human nature that wants to impose either-or frameworks on situations that are much more fluid than either-or. And I don't know where this comes from exactly. It might be because fluidity is too much and people want it to be simpler. I'm not really sure. There are a lot of explanations I can come up with. But one of the things that I see overall in publishing right now, from the standpoint of authors, is this. We have choices now. Before we didn't. Before, your choice was which legacy publisher, which traditional publisher am I going to go with. That was pretty much it. And these are just kind of different hues, but really the same color palette. They all work pretty much the same way. But that's not the case anymore. Now we have radically different alternatives. One of them, the most obvious, of course, is self-publishing, which is primarily digital, but not entirely. That's another common misperception. We have to distinguish between paper and digital on the one hand and brick-and-mortar and online bookstores on the other. Every self-published author I know, including myself, makes all the books available in paper, as well as online. So you can order all my self-published books on paper from, for example, from Amazon. But they're not widely available in really virtually self-published books are hardly available at all in brick-and-mortar stores. So anyway, those are just concepts that people should keep in mind, paper and digital and brick-and-mortar and online. So anyway, the big question for a writer today is, what's the best way for me to publish the new book? Before, I didn't have a choice, and I have a choice. Do I want to go the legacy route? Do I want to self-publish? Or do I want to publish with a new publisher like Amazon, which to me represents a kind of hybrid model offering various benefits of both the legacy and the self-publishing systems? So I do a lot of talking and writing about this, and really what I advise people is to, I don't think there's any one-size-fits-all, number one. And number two, I think it's important to stop thinking in terms of either-or, like, well, am I going to become a self-published author? Am I going to become a legacy published author, Amazon published author? We authors should keep in mind that, look, for any given book, you'll have to make a choice. Although the choice could change. You could start by selling. This has happened all the time. You could self-publish the book, and then possibly you'll be made a very attractive legacy offer, and you'll wind up legacy publishing the book. That's happened. We've seen some really interesting deals, like one by Hugh Howey and another by Bella Andre, where these guys have had enormous success with a self-published book, and then have wound up selling the paper, only the paper rights, to a legacy publisher. I think that's awesome. That's another possibility. But with any given book, you can say, well, this one I think I want to do by myself, but this other one here, I think I want to do with you, Mr. Traditional Publisher, and over there, I think we want to do that with, we want to do this third one with Amazon. It's possible to do a mix over the course of career, and why would you not want to do that? I mean, if one system's working super well for you, then stick with it. But you might find that a mix works well. Again, no one size fits all. So in Be the Monkey, Joe and I talk about a lot of the questions I think people might want to ask in order to decide what is the best route for them. And very briefly, some of those questions would be, well, if you're offered, let's say you do have a choice, and someone has put a legacy contract in front of you and said, hey, we want to publish your books. So how big is the advance, right? I mean, that could almost end the inquiry. Assuming that money is reasonably important to you, I could probably name a dollar amount that will then obviate all your other concerns and values, right? I don't know what it is. It could be like, be $1,000, probably not. It'd be $1 million, maybe. It'd be $10 million, yeah, I think so. So, if somebody says, look, I will give you $10 million for that book, then I would say do whatever you want with it. That's fine. You give me $10 million, so you can do anything you want with it. That would be one, but that's one value. It's only one, and probably nobody's going to offer you $10 million. So how big is the advance? How important is the advance to you? How much do you need the money right up front? Some people need the money right away. That makes it more valuable. Some people don't need it at all. I doubt an advance is very important to Stephen King. He's probably planning for something else. How important to you is time to market? Because if you go with the legacy publisher, the book is not going to be available for a lot longer. If you self-publish it, it'll be available to readers who can then buy it immediately upon its completion. So, and by completion, I don't just mean you finish the first draft. I mean polished completion, like conceptual editing, line editing, copy editing, proofreading, all that, digital formatting, et cetera. But when all that stuff is done and self-publishing, publishing then becomes, as Clay Shirky said, a button. You press a button, and the book is 100% as available as any legacy published book ever has been in digital. Not so much in paper. So this is another important question you have to ask yourself. How much do you expect to sell in digital? How much do you expect to sell in paper? To use two extreme examples, if you think you're going to sell 100% or nearly 100% in paper, and you're going to sell almost no books in digital, then you're really, functionally, you're not in a different position than someone would have been in 10 years ago before digital even existed. You need that paper distribution partner, and you really don't have much of a choice about it, because in self-publishing, you can make a decent amount of money selling paper books online. I mean, I know Joe makes tens of thousands of dollars a year just from selling his books in paper online, and that's not chump change, obviously, but he's making over $1 million a year self-publishing his digital books. So if you expect to sell almost entirely paper and very little digital, that's probably going to suggest that you go the legacy route. If the reverse is true and you expect to sell almost no paper and almost entirely in digital, then probably you're looking at something where self-publishing is going to make more sense for you, because in self-publishing you typically keep 4 times the per unit royalty in digital than you would have kept in a legacy contract. So what that means is, look, if you're only going to sell digital books, let's suppose, or nearly only digital books, then a legacy publisher has to be able to say to you, hey, we will move more than 4 times the number of units together than you would be able to move on your own. So even though you're only making 25%, even though you'd be making 4 times the per unit royalty on your own, we will sell, for example, 5 times the volume. You'll make it up on volume and make more money for us. But that's a big promise. That's a really big promise, to say we can sell more than 4 times the amount together that you could sell yourself. So these are the sorts of things you want to try to puzzle out. Also, what's almost like emotionally, what's important to you? How much do you like to be in control? How much are you comfortable seeing control with regard to things like the book title, the book cover, the overall packaging, branding, that sort of thing? Those are things you have to think about. If you're kind of a control freak and you trust your own judgment, maybe you have some business experience, marketing experience, sales experience, then you probably are more comfortable and desirous of being in charge. If you're not very good and experienced in these areas, you might be more comfortable in ceding control of those areas to someone else. That would be to your publisher. Off the top of my head, those are some of the primary things people should think about. The money, in terms of how big is the advance, how important is the advance, The royalties, which you won't get in advance in self-publishing, obviously, the royalties per unit are going to be much more favorable in self-publishing, approximately four times the amount in digital. How much do you think you're going to sell in paper versus digital? These are things to think about. How important is time to market you? Are you willing to wait 6 months, a year, 2 years before the book is even available to readers? Or do you want to make it available right away? And also your own personality and personal needs, personal objectives, skills, that sort of thing. What will probably be the better fit there? And I know this is kind of a long answer, but believe it or not, for someone who's really faced with this decision, in a way, this is just framework stuff. On any one of these topics, you can delve a lot deeper to try to come up with an answer that's going to be most useful and meaningful for yourself. But anyway, I sometimes get called like a proselytizer for self-publishing or something like that, and that's an easy misnomer, or call it easy propaganda, to fall into. It's not really true. If I proselytize for anything, it's the value of choice for authors. I think it is wonderful that authors have choices now where we didn't before. I just think that's an inherently good thing. Certainly it's a good thing for authors. Whether you're a legacy publisher and you feel it's good, I understand. There's a different viewpoint there. But I myself am an author, and I think this is great news for authors. How any particular author decides for herself or himself, I don't care. I hope people decide knowingly. I hope that they have a good framework and they think it through carefully and come up with outcomes that are best for themselves. That's my concern. But which outcome is right for any particular author? Again, there's no one-size-fits-all. To the extent that I talk a lot about this stuff, it's to disseminate information I think that will be useful to authors so that they can customize decisions and arrive at different outcomes, but the best outcomes for themselves. And then one last thought on this. Someone had this too. I mean, the other thing that's most important to me, arguably both out of self-interest as an author, but also out of self-interest, insofar as I'm a member of society, reading is hugely important to me. And I believe that the more people read, the better off we are, other things being equal. So I think reading is, most people, I think, agree with that. Like, you want to be part of a society that's heavily invested in reading. Reading is a good thing. So then the question is, okay, if you think that reading is a good thing, then you want to reverse engineer from that. What makes more people be able to read? And one thing I would say is, well, lower priced books that are more ubiquitously available, right? Those have got to be good things. If you want more people to read, reduce the obstacles, make the books more widely available, easier to get, and lower priced. And so I'm very much in favor of more widely available, easier to get, and lower priced books. For people who argue against these things, who talk about devaluing the book, this nonsensical phrase, because individual books are starting to cost consumers less, meaning that consumers can buy more of them, people who talk that way, they it's not that they don't have values. It's just that, and it's not, obviously, and it's not just that, and I'm not suggesting that they don't value readers and they don't value reading. They do. They clearly do. But they don't prioritize readers and they don't prioritize reading. There's something more important to them. And that's a whole different story about what that thing might be. But if you argue for higher priced books and more limited access to books, then as much as you might value reading and readers, you are valuing something else more, because there's simply no question, it's axiomatic, that if books cost less and are more widely available and easier to get, then they will be more widely read. I don't think that's even arguable. So if you're against lower priced, more available, more ubiquitous books, easier to get books, then I think you owe it to yourself to ask, what is it that I value more here than more people reading more? And I think that's an important question.
You know,
sorry, I told you that might be a long answer.
No, it was great, and it's exactly what I wanted. One of the things that came out of you making this momentous decision a few years ago was all of a sudden the prejudice towards self-published authors was reduced. It hasn't gone away. I mean, it's a little bit like we talked about the prejudice with audiobooks. You know, there is a prejudice, but there's less of a prejudice now when you can point to an author that most readers know and say, he made this choice, or she made this choice, or look at the quality of the work that Hugh Howey is putting out. And how can you say that there's something inherently wrong about the work that he's doing. And
well, you can't, except as the product, again, as the product of prejudice and thoughtlessness. And I think if I did anything if my decision did anything to chip away at that prejudice, I'm glad. But that was more just, you know, in the overall chipping away of that prejudice, the publicity surrounding my decision to self-publish instead of taking the $500,000 was just one, like one hammer blow among many. I think over time, as people are exposed to information, some good thinking, and particularly to the books themselves. You mentioned Hugh Howey, I mentioned Bela Andre a little while ago. There's so many others. Really good books that cannot be distinguished in any meaningful way from legacy published books. Over time, people will start to realize, hey, it doesn't really matter how the book is published. You know, the proof is in the taste of the pudding. And by the way, it's very interesting to see what happens to a prejudice that's starting to come into contact with reality. It doesn't usually die easily. It morphs, it twists, it contorts. And one of the ways I've seen this, self-publishing bad, the self-published books are bad, zombie meme twist in trying to twist away from reality is something like this. There's a zombie meme that Joe and I have been calling for years, Joe Conrad and I have been calling for years, the tsunami of crap. And it goes like this. So the idea is like, look, in an age where anyone can publish a book digitally, then everyone or whatever, too many people will be publishing books, and there'll be hundreds of thousands, even millions of shitty books published, because most of them will be shitty, and the public will not be able to find the good stuff anymore, and we'll all drown in a tsunami of crap, and Western civilization will be swept away. I'm only exaggerating a tiny bit. That's pretty much... that is the nature of the zombie meme. But then, if you think about this for a minute, it doesn't make any sense, first, because there's already so much crap in among legacy published books. I mean, to any given person, most of what is published will, at the minimum, not be interesting to you. So then the question is, well, how do you find what's interesting? Because anyone who's walked into, you can walk into even a very small bookstore. They have thousands of titles. That's a small bookstore. A Barnes & Noble superstore, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of titles. And hundreds of thousands of new titles are being published every single year. And, of course, there's online where it's millions of titles. So already, before digital distribution, there were already, before self-publishing, there were already literally millions of books available. How did we ever find which ones were good? It wasn't the gatekeepers who were doing it. That was the sort of some function. Right? It's like they reduced from a possible 10 million books, they reduced that to a million books. But that's not, come on, I mean, that's not really a meaningful winning if I'm a consumer and trying to find a book. So lots of third-party systems come to the fore to help people, to help consumers win a choice to an acceptable level. It's a demand-side problem. It exists everywhere where there's too much choice to individually sample. So think about it. Movies, music, travel, restaurants, can't possibly sample all these things yourself. You can't, it's like, there are 12 movies playing this week at the Cinemaplex. I will go and see a few minutes of each one, and that's all I'll decide. That's silly. We all know that. So what happens is third parties, reviewers, there's word of mouth. There are a lot of different ways by which choice is winnowed to an acceptably small set so that we can make our own decisions from within that small set. And here are some other good examples. So this has always been going on in the book world. If the tsunami of crap argument were true, the tsunami of crap argument is if there's no gatekeepers, if there are no traditional gatekeepers, and anybody can publish, then we'll never be able to find anything useful and all is lost. If that were true, then the internet itself could not exist in any kind of meaningful way. I don't know if you can hear those air raid sounds. I don't know what causes that at noon.
Dan, how exciting for you.
It seems meaningful somehow. Anyway, because think about it. I think probably to the extent something like this could be described in objective terms, but certainly in subjective terms, 99.999% of the internet, or 99.999999999% of the infinity of the internet is crap. And yet, somehow, people are able to find web pages, websites, that are useful and beneficial and interesting to them, which they then use. This is an undeniable fact that in the face of a sea of crap, an infinite ocean of crap, people continue to find useful islands on the Internet. So if it works for the Internet, I'm pretty sure it's going to be okay just for published books, too. Pretty sure. The Internet's going to be a lot bigger than publishing ever itself could be. Anyway, so that's the response to the whole zombie of crap meme. There's a tendency that I find super interesting, a human nature tendency that's been, at least for me, exposed and kind of brought into sharp focus by the revolution in publishing, and it's this. People seem to conflate a function with the entity that has traditionally provided that function. So, for example, there is a traditional important gatekeeping function that's always been provided by legacy publishers. I mean, they screen out, I don't know what the size of the slush pile is compared to what actually gets published, but it's a pretty big ratio. I don't know what it is, like 100 to 1, 1,000 to 1, 10,000 to 1, whatever it is. It's big. So they do provide this traditional gatekeeping function that helps consumers win a choice, somewhat. I don't want to make too much of it because we're still talking about, in the end, hundreds of thousands of books a year. That's a lot to choose from, and so you need more than just the gatekeeping function. But they have provided this traditional gatekeeping function, and so people feel like, oh, well, that's the function is winnowing choice. The entity that has always helped with that function is gatekeeping. Ergo, if we eliminate the gatekeepers, we eliminate function, and that's neither logically nor empirically correct. The function is not the same as the entity that's always been providing it. If you eliminate the gatekeepers and there's even more choice, then you will get even more third-party systems to help consumers winnow choice. Things like customer reviews, even better customer reviews, where customers are then reviewing each other's reviews for reliability, for example, the star system. Things like this, these are all examples of new ways to help consumers winnow choice. It's a demand problem. If gatekeepers go away, traditional gatekeepers, if that is lost, I promise you, other systems will come into effect to help consumers win a choice because consumers want that and need it.
And the systems that are there now, you mentioned the star systems, just individual reviews, talking to your friends, the same way we've always found out about books is talking to our friends.
Of course.
It does a great
reviews.
Job of winnowing out the crap. Of course, you can game the system a little bit, but you can only do it a little bit. You're not going to publish 10 books that way.
That's right. And not just that, in terms of people saying, you're right, you can always game the system at least a little bit. But man, a system where that's not true.
Yeah,
all
true.
All systems have their rules, their vulnerabilities, and part of the skill you want to develop if you're in business is to understand the way your ecosystem works so that you can then work it to your maximum advantage. I mean, this is certainly true in the legacy world. Like, why would you send an advanced reading copy to Janet Maslin at the New York Times or offer to take her out to lunch, try to develop a personal relationship and meet her at a cocktail party or whatever it is you do? I mean, that's just, I'm not saying any of this stuff is illicit or in any way corrupt. It's obviously not. It's just routine, trivial examples of someone saying, Janet Maslin has a lot of impact on people's book buying, book reading habits. Now, how can I get her to pay attention to this book when there are so many other people vying for her attention? That's just part of the game. It always has been and always will be. And the rules will be a little different. The tactics will be different depending on the system. But, you know, it's another thing that concerns me. It's another aspect of human nature that has interested me a lot that's been exposed by this revolution in publishing. And it's this. When something's new, people will often try to identify problems in it that are not new problems, but are in fact universal problems that have always existed, including in the original system that's being displaced by the emerging one. So, I mean, a trivial example would be saying, like, well, couldn't people game that a little bit? In most cases, they certainly can, could, and they will, just like they always have in every other system. The tsunami of crap is the ultimate example, where, you know, they're like, what will we do? There'll be too many books that we won't be able to choose. It's like, you know, as opposed to right now, when I mean, walking to a Barnes & Noble superstore, and there are 300,000 books. What do? Do you actually sample each one yourself? That's absurd. So this is not a new problem. And there's so many other examples of it. I've heard people say, like, why, you're self-publishing? How are you going to get, again, discoverability is that buzzword, right? How are you going to get noticed? And I'm like, well, there are various ways you can get noticed. We know this is an empirical fact. We have several huge, more than several, depending on how you want to define huge. We have at least several self-publishing superstars who are making over $1 million a year from self-publishing. And we have now, I mean, countless, really thousands of self-publishing people who are just quietly making anywhere between five figures and six figures a year just self-publishing their books. So we know empirically it is a fact that someone can get noticed, that thousands of people can get noticed in self-publishing. And it's, and the fact that, you know, it's like, how are you going to do it? How is always a question. There's no guarantee you're going to be discovered or noticed if you get a legacy contract. That itself is, of course, a logical fallacy, perhaps peddled in part deliberately by the gatekeeping, culture guarding, nurturing, guardians of the legacy system, but maybe not. Maybe it's just an artifact. There's no guarantee that you'll ever be discovered. Discoverability is always a challenge in every system. It has been since the first caveman made a slightly better, I don't know, hammer or something like that and decided, hey, how am I going to get people to buy this from me for like a buffalo hide or whatever? I don't know. How do you get discovered? It's always a challenge. There are different ways of doing it, but it's not like discoverability is this new problem of self-publishing. That's not thoughtful.
Now, Amazon has come up with this new way of helping lesser-known authors become discovered through existing fictional characters, like
Kindle
Worlds. You're a part of that. Most people don't understand anything about that. Could you sort of explain the program and then let us know how it's worked for John Rain?
Yeah, sure. The easiest way to understand it is most people know what fan fiction is. And I think this has been a little bit of a marketing challenge for Amazon because the term fan fiction has a little bit of a bad reputation, at least depending on who you're talking to.
It sounds like teenage girls writing stories about a TV show to me using the term fan fiction. So I hear you there.
I'm not an expert, but that sounds like one example of fan fiction. But most people know what it is. It's just basically somebody is inspired by a book or television or series of books or television series or movies or whatever and decides to start writing stories with those characters, sometimes mixing different universes together. But the idea is that it's inspired by something. I think it started with Star Trek. Again, I'm far from an expert on fan fiction. But so people just start saying, God, I love these characters. I'm going to start writing my own original stories with these characters. It's technically a copyright violation. Maybe that's uncomfortable to use the word technically. It is a copyright violation if you're publishing it. I say technically because as an author, I really don't. It doesn't bother me at all. If anything, it only helps me sell more. Fan fiction only helps me sell more of my underlying books, so it's not costing me anything. If anything, it's making me money. I don't object to it. But yes, technically it is a copyright violation, and probably a lot of it, or most of it, is amateurish and bad. But by the standards of, at least by professional quality standards, on the other hand, people are clearly enjoying themselves doing it and clearly enjoying reading it, and I don't see what's wrong with that. So, but the point is, so this is what fan fiction is, and it's got a bad reputation because, yeah, a lot of it, maybe even most of it, is amateurish. I mean, on the other hand, apparently a lot of it can be extremely effective. 50 Shades of Grey started out as Twilight fan fiction, and then E.O. James, I think is the name of the author, took out the names that made it a copyright violation, and as we know, it went on to make, I don't know, $50 million a year or more, mm-hmm. Some crazy amount of money. So I haven't read it. I couldn't tell you my opinion about whether it's good or bad, but I can say that millions of people are hugely enjoying it, so in that sense, it must be good. And that started as fan fiction. Anyway, fan fiction, though, overall, I think is probably known as kind of amateurish stuff. So Amazon's challenge has been, look, how do we start something that is functionally a program of licensed fan fiction, legal fan fiction, non-copyright violating fan fiction? How do we do that without people thinking of it as, oh, it's fan fiction, it's probably not very good? That's a marketing challenge. But the underlying idea is pretty simple and straightforward. It's like, hey, we've got I don't know, tens of thousands of talented, passionate writers out there who are writing this stuff for free, and they're not making any money from it. And we could create a program where authors, entirely voluntarily, nobody has to do this, could license third parties to do what they're already doing, and then we could sell it. and we'd all split the profits. The fan fiction author would roughly take a third, the underlying rights holder would take a third, and we, Amazon, would take a third. It's actually 35%, 35%, 30%, I think, is the typical Kindle world split. My own view, program is brilliant. I think it's nothing but win. If you're an author and you find personally the idea of anybody writing fan fiction based on your work, whether licensed or unlicensed, if you find that idea for any reason offensive, you don't like it, that's fine. You don't have to do it. And I know there's some really big names out there who seem to hate fan fiction. Anne Rice, George R. R. Martin, Stephen King. I don't want to attribute too strongly to them any ideas, because I've read in interviews where they've spoken out that they really don't like this idea that other people are taking their characters and writing stories using those characters. And if I'm wrong, and any of Anne Rice or George R. R. Martin or Stephen King happens to listen to this interview, then I apologize if I've mischaracterized your view. I'm pretty sure that I'm right about this. Certainly, at any rate, many authors they're just not comfortable with the idea of other people taking their characters. On an emotional level, I totally understand that. So the beauty of it is, you don't have to do this. Be aware that people are doing it on their own, whether they're part of Kindle Worlds or whatever. So like, the fact that you don't join Kindle Worlds does not stop fan fiction. It just means that the only fan fiction for your books will be unlicensed. I mean, I can't even imagine how much there must be on George R. 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 Martin's books. There's just so much rich material in there. But anyway, so it's good for authors. I think those authors who want to take advantage of it can. Those who don't want to can steer clear of it, absolutely. It's great for people who like to write fan fiction, because now they actually could make some money from it if it's good, define good by there's an audience for it. How can you objectively define good? It's not easy. But if it's the kind of fiction that is going to garner an audience, then it will find an audience, and for the first time you can actually make money from it. It's not just a labor of love. It can also provide some sort of income stream. And for the author who wants to take advantage of it, instead of having people write fan fiction and you're not making any money from your underlying intellectual property, you can now license that intellectual property and turn it into an income stream. So, and the other thing about this that I think is not very well understood by authors is this. In digital especially, the more people talk about discoverability, it's always a challenge, no doubt. One way that you solve address the discoverability problem online is by having lots of books, or more broadly speaking, having lots of routes by which people can discover your books. So the more ways that people who haven't heard of you can hear of you, well, that's better. If in a world where discoverability has become maybe the chief challenge of published writers. So if today I only have one book or five books or something like that, then let's just say that at least in terms of how many books I have, there are only five routes that people can find to my collected body of works, books 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and that's it. But now let's say I've got 25 Kindle World writers all writing John Rain books. Well, now, in addition to my own five books, I've got these other 25 authors, 25 books out there that themselves provide a route back to my underlying body of work. In addition to making money from those Kindle Worlds volumes themselves, those volumes provide a whole new series of routes by which people can find me. And I think so. To me, this is good for it. Readers will find books that they love. If they don't like them, they'll put one-star reviews up, and that'll be pretty much the end of that. So readers are going to have new books they love. Authors will have new ways of making money, and people who are formerly writing unlicensed fan fiction and making no money from it will now be able to do so with a proper license and a resulting income stream. I just think it's great for everyone. And again, if you don't like it and it makes you uncomfortable, that's totally fine. There's no right or wrong answer. You just don't have to do it. It's cool. So anyway, I love Kindle Worlds. I think it's just super smart. It's one of those insights that seems obvious in retrospect, but nobody spotted it beforehand. I think Amazon has done a great job of putting it together. If anyone wants to read a little more about this, I did a Q&A with the head of the Kindle Worlds program. Excuse me. Phil Patrick, it's on my blog, and the easiest way to find it is if you just Google Barry Eisler or Philip Patrick, it'll take you right to the blog post in question. But it's the whole Q&A about what is Kindle Worlds, what's behind it, what's it going to do, a lot of you guys jazzed about it. It was kind of a tough interview, too. I mean, Philip and I joked about it now. I think he was expecting me to go easy on Ben. He was mistaken. So I think it was just a really good, informative interview, but I was pressing reasonably hard, I think, on some points that concerned me, mostly having to do with the Kindle World's rules on explicit sex, because, you know, I'm a fan of explicit sex in fiction, and I don't want to see it restricted unduly. So we talked a lot about that kind of stuff.
And what was the result? Had they banned it in the Kindle World?
No, there was no ban, but they have some overarching guidelines, which I understand, and this is what I was trying to tease out in the interview. I mean, there's always danger if you're any kind of a content, not a content creator, but like a content access provider. There's always danger that you're going to be sued for some content that's being hosted on your site. And we've seen huge suits in this regard, like Viacom against YouTube. YouTube enables people to post videos. Somebody posts an infringing video, and who, are you going to sue the person who did it? The guy doesn't have any money. You're Viacom. No, you're going to sue YouTube on the theory that YouTube enabled the copyright infringement. Or if somebody were to post an offensive video, something that offended a lot of people, then that could be associated, that could become associated with the person who provided access to that offensive content. If you're Disney, for example, you want to guard your brand very jealously. You wouldn't want people to be able to do things that would associate, like, salacious content with Disney, because that would be, that would harm Disney's brand. So with all this in mind, on the one hand, I totally understand why Amazon might want to have its own content guidelines built into the Kindle World licenses themselves, such that if somebody wanted to post something that Amazon felt like, look, we as a company, because of our brand and our reputation, we don't want to be associated with this. Like, to take an example that I don't think too many people would disagree with, at least if not on the principle level and certainly on the execution level. What if somebody wanted to write a series of books advocating child molestation? You can certainly understand where Amazon or any company with a reputation the brand is trying to protect would say, forget about the substantive problems of advocating child molestation, but just in terms of your own reputation, you might want to say, look, we do not want to be perceived as having to do anything with this, and we want to maintain our ability to not have anything to do with this and to demonstrate that we don't have anything to do with this. So I get that. I really get that. That's one thing that's going on, and if I were Amazon, it would be important to me. On the other hand, as an author and an individual, I'm always leery of systems that might have the effect, either intentional or incidental, of chilling free speech. So it's an interesting question of how you draw the line. And because in Kindle worlds, authors do get to include their own guidelines. So, for example, if you wanted to say, I don't know, like, okay, you can write John Rayne books, but you can't mix John Rayne with any other characters from any other books, even if you have a license from that author, too. If you wanted to put that in your guidelines, you could. You could say all John Rayne books in the Kindle Worlds program have to take place in Hoboken, New Jersey. You could put that in there. I wouldn't advise that. I don't think it would be sensible on a variety of levels, but you could do that, and then all Kindle World's genre and fiction would take place in Hoboken, et cetera. So you have that, and you could say no explicit sex, and I mean, try to define explicit sex. I don't know how you would really do it. But you could say no graphic depictions of, you know, genital penetration or whatever it is that is your personal bugaboo or that you find offensive to your own brand. You can build that into the individual Kindle World's license as the author. So my question to Amazon was, well, look, if authors can already do this, why include your own guidelines? I have no guidelines in my Kindle World's licenses because, for what it's worth, as long as people understand that I didn't write the book, then I don't care what people write, and I'm it just doesn't bother me. I mean, it's their interpretation. They were inspired by my books to take my characters and put them in these, you could be completely way out situations, even ones that I might find like, wow, I would never do that. That's totally not my characters. But that's not the point. This is someone else's interpretation. And as long as the public understands I didn't write it, then I don't think it affects my brand or my reputation. So that's how I look at it. But I also understand from Amazon's point of view that they want to have some overarching ability to distance themselves from content that might cause them brand or reputational or even legal problems. So the question is, how do you draw that balance? And Philip and I talked about that at some length. I think it was a pretty interesting conversation.
Well, we've been talking with Barry Eisler, the author of Graveyard of Memories. Barry, you have been incredibly generous with your time today and with your knowledge. I can't thank you enough for being on Murders, Mysteries, and Mayhem.
You are very kind, Steve. Thanks for all the good questions, and I hope some of this will be interesting for anyone who's listening, useful to anyone who's listening to it.
I have no doubt that it will. This show is owned and copyrighted in full by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC, produced by Pam Stack. This is Stephen Campbell with Murders, Mysteries, and Mayhem, and we hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to stay up to date with show schedules and other news, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and at www.authorsontheair.com.